This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It sort of behooves everybody, from the smallest investor to the CEO of the, you know, major multinational corporation, to figure out how to deal with it. If governments are saying that they are going to steadily move away from fossil fuel companies, then we have to start thinking about where we invest money.
Victor Hugo said of Paris that nothing was more fantastic, more tragic, or more sublime. Will the same ever be said of the COP21 climate agreement brokered this month in the iconic city? Today on Sea Change Radio, we recap the climate summit with prominent freelance journalist Vivian Walt. We discuss the impact of the Paris Agreement on the world's largest polluters, explore how big banks and deep-pocketed interests are reacting to the pact, and examine efforts to accelerate the transition to clean energy in developing nations. Walt also talks about how the world views U.S. climate skepticism and what effect the November terrorist attacks and climate protests had on the summit. I'm joined now by journalist Vivian Walt. She writes for Time Magazine and other publications. Vivian, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You're not strictly an environmental reporter. You cover a wide range of topics, but you covered the climate summit in Paris, the COP21, or as they say in French, the COP21. Why don't you give us a summary of the agreement that was signed, if you can?
Sure. In some ways, the agreement went much further than anybody expected. It had two basic elements in it, which were, in the minds of many environmentalists, crucial, but ones that they never thought that they would actually see written into the document. The first was that there was going to be an effort, in fact, a commitment by virtually every country in the world to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. That's about 3.7 degrees Fahrenheit above what it was around the time of the Industrial Revolution. That scientists believe is really a bottom line in order to stave off climate disaster. But what the Paris Agreement did that was even more important was that it made clear that this was actually not enough and that countries had to start moving towards a 1.5 degrees Celsius world. In other words, to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees over the Industrial Revolution temperature. So that was kind of a stunner that nobody expected to actually make it into the final document. The second thing that was very important was that it committed every country in the world to do what was called a stocktaking, to look at what they had done every 5 years. So what the French did in the run-up to these Paris talks was that they had demanded from every country in the world a list of commitments that they could do over the next several decades in order to rein in their carbon emissions and make the transition to renewables. And they got, in fact, 185 such submissions. And they set those aside, and they then thrashed out this Paris Agreement, which is not very long. The actual agreement is just a couple of pages long. And each country then has sort of ownership of this agreement and uses its own declared commitments as a kind of roadmap for how to put in effect the Paris Agreement.
And assuming all the countries abide by this agreement, which countries have the toughest road to hoe to meet these standards?
Well, the two big polluters of the world are China and the US right now. And together, they made a very strong joint commitment to put in effect a big energy transition. That was a major thing. It's not going to be easy, obviously. This has got big political battles ahead in Congress and in China, which is still growing at over 6% a year. And they are going to have an enormous job to put in effect all the infrastructure they need in order to move away from their heavy dependence on coal. So those are really, really difficult things. The other big one to watch is India, which also has an enormous job ahead of it. And in fact, the Prime Minister Narendra Modi was a very big figure at COP21. And also launched a major international solar alliance in order to bring together all the kind of emerging countries of the global south, many of the African countries, to start sharing solar technology in partnership with the US and China. So everybody in their own way has enormous challenges, and it will remain to be seen how strong people's political systems are in order to hold their governments to account, to make sure that they keep on track in the years ahead along the lines of the Paris Agreement.
And maybe you could talk about the fund that's being set up to assist poorer countries in trying to mitigate the effects of climate change as well, as they continue to try to provide for their people the same kind of reliance on energy that we have in countries like France and the US.
There was a very big debate which lasted all through the 2 weeks of COP21, and that was who should pay for this huge saving of the planet. And many of the big emerging countries, especially India, argued, why should we have to pay? We weren't the ones that polluted the planet. We were, you know, living in poor villages with no electricity. And it really should be the West, who messed up the planet in the first place, who pays in order to clean it up. So this was an argument that basically was never resolved. It dominated the talks for many, many days. And here is what it comes down to. The rich countries have committed themselves, but not exactly on paper, to giving poor countries $100 billion a year from 2020. That's not a lot of money, although it sounds like a lot. But when you're talking about trying to overhaul the entire world's energy systems, it's probably going to require an awful lot more money than that. The other big piece of this is what the private sector will do. And increasingly, governments realize that they can't do this without enormous input from big business. And much of big business was in Paris for COP21. You had huge announcements by Bill Gates, by, you know, the CEOs of all sorts of major companies, saying, we want to get on board with this. We see this as our future. We're going to put tens of billions of dollars into innovation. We think that that's absolutely key. We have to start innovating new technologies. We don't have the systems in place to really move away from fossil fuels. So that is a pretty hopeful sign. And increasingly, there's a third element which has to do with money, and that is that an awful lot of people are seeing that there's going to be a sort of momentum that takes off as a result of the Paris Agreement that is essentially investor-driven, and that a lot of investors will say, you know, we don't really want these enormous holdings of big oil companies in our portfolios. We don't want the fate of our pensions wrapped up with the fate of ExxonMobil, for example, because we see that like in 30 or 40 or 50 years, these oil companies might not be worth nearly as much as they are today. And they say that that kind of momentum will almost have a kind of life of its own, that it won't be dependent on international deals or whatever. It will simply be an outgrowth of the world's governments deciding that they need to transition out of fossil fuels.
Ils sont toujours en arrière quand le vent nous souffle dans le dos. Ils sont là quand même. Ils ont les yeux vers la terre quand les autres regardent tout en haut. Ils nous voient quand même. Ils n'ont pas les mots faciles tout autour. On en dit un peu trop. Ils nous parlent quand même.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist Vivian Walt, who recently covered the Paris Climate Summit. She's based in Paris. So Vivian, you actually just recently penned a piece for Fortune, which chronicles the reaction to the Paris Climate Deal by some of the larger banks and business interests. Maybe you can kind of sketch out for our listeners the dynamic that some of these deep moneyed interests are trying to wade between when it comes to weighing the potential sunk cost of stranded assets versus the opportunities that await them if they invest heavily in clean energy.
So big business was there in force, and it's not like they were there to make deals, or not that I know of, even though, you know, every country in the world was there and it was a very prized networking opportunity. But in so many different panel discussions and press briefings and one-on-one meetings and bilateral meetings that took place in the dozens and dozens of little conference rooms that were set up around the COP21 government talks, you had bankers and investment advisors and big CEOs of major corporations, Fortune 500 corporations, discussing what the future of this economy was going to look like. And by and large, the message was, look, for the last 100 years or so, we've been driven by a kind of fossil fuel company. The big oil and gas companies is really what has driven industrial growth, and coal companies, of course. They have driven industrial growth in every country of the world for the last century. This is in such flux now that it sort of behooves everybody, from the smallest investor to the CEO of the, you know, major multinational corporation, to figure out how to deal with it. If governments are saying that they are going to steadily move away from fossil fuel companies, then we have to start thinking about where we invest money. Clearly, there's very rapid growth at the moment in some of the renewable companies, especially solar power, for example. But on top of that, there's a very real possibility that you could have what is called stranded assets. If you imagine that oil companies have concessions on various blocks that they explore, they find, you know, big oil finds or gas finds off the coast of, you know, Brazil or the coast of North Africa or all over the world, and they put these proven reserves on their books as part of their company's valuation. This is what makes some of these oil and gas companies so enormously valuable, is because they've locked up these reserves that lie under the ground or under the sea around the planet. However, these are reserves that might not be actually drilled out of the ground or out of the sea for the next 15, 20 years. And those are, you know, that is a date at which governments have said that they're going to be using a lot less oil and gas than they are now. So just arithmetically, you look at the way this is going, it's not as if Wall Street woke up this week and said, oh my God, you know, we'd better get out of fossil fuels. However, there is this niggling feeling that there might be trillions of dollars worth of proven oil and gas reserves out there that might actually never be drilled. And the one most interesting panel that I went to, which was actually introduced by Al Gore, had on it one of the top executives from Total, the big French oil company, who basically said, look, the world has changed and the future is going to be very different. And there's going to be a lot of fossil fuels that we have as our proven reserves on the books that are actually never going to be drilled. So that was kind of a stunning admission and put in words a feeling that was kind of rippling through the conference over the last 2 weeks.
Yes, the quote that you used was, he said, we will have to adapt, which is, and also I was kind of surprised that there is a VP for climate energy at a company like Total. That's kind of that's a positive development. So it sounds like a company with stranded assets is already looking towards making investments that are going to have to be under the rubric of COP21. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And, you know, Total has been one of the more forward-thinking companies on this. They started investing heavily in solar power at least 5 years ago, I believe. You know, I think a number of the European companies like Statoil, the big Norwegian oil company, they have for a while been talking about getting into renewable energy and have been investing heavily because they just see that, you know, maybe it's not happening in 2015, but these are companies which look at very long-term deals. They're signing concessions on blocks which might be 20-year concessions. So they're looking out, you know, one generation from now and seeing potentially a very different world for them. Now, this doesn't mean that you want, you know, Exxon to be building solar farms. I mean, Exxon is very, very good at drilling oil, but they're not necessarily the best company to, you know, put in place clean energy. They have not built their skill set or their business model on that.
As a reporter who's covered a wide range of topics, I'd like to get your perspective on a few of the political aspects of this. Since we're talking about the big oil companies like Exxon and Total, ExxonMobil has been in the news a lot for the last 3-4 months because of the discovery that they knew much earlier than many, many people about the realities of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. They are not denying that climate change exists. And yet the right wing in the United States, their talking point is that there's still not enough science in. Maybe you can give us an idea of the reaction to climate denialism in the U.S. from your view there in Paris.
Well, you know, within the little bubble, or should I say the very big bubble that constituted COP21, I mean, it felt like its own little planet on, you know, at some points. You know, there was just a kind of total befuddlement about the climate skeptics, as if they just couldn't figure out what on earth, you know, they were thinking. And it is kind of easy to lose that perspective that, you know, climate skepticism is certainly real and maybe even quite widespread in the US, and not only in the US, but in other countries like Russia, Venezuela, and very, you know, not many, but some countries. And, you know, I think that people simply just kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, you know, that it's kind of a dying phase and these people will be gone soon and, you know, they're not serious. And they might be right, although, of course, one has to deal with it in terms of what the US can do. Now, the US has committed itself to cutting back carbon emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025. And as far as I know, they're making good progress on that, actually. Obama's clean power plan, his various things that he's put in place have really kind of accelerated that process quite a lot. I did interview the energy secretary while he was in Paris, Ernest Moniz, and he said that he didn't think that Washington was that much of a problem and that the administration could essentially put in place everything it needed to put in place without having it go through Congress.
You speak to me, yes, I ain't language, as I'm eating a sandwich in a small cafe at a quarter to three. Well, I can't respond, you're sign language, you're taking
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist Vivian Walt. She's based in Paris. How do you think COP21 would have gone if there were a President Ted Cruz or Donald Trump in office right now?
If there had not been President Obama, if there had been, I suppose, somebody as U.S. president who was far more of a climate skeptic, obviously, we would have had a very, very different COP21. In several interviews I did, people made the point that this was the first time the U.S. really had a big role in the climate talks, and that the very fact that they did had completely changed the dynamic of the talks, that it just made everything, it took everything up several notches of seriousness globally. There's another point that needs to be made about President Obama, and that is that about a year ago, he flew to Beijing and had a very serious meeting with President Xi, the Chinese president, in which the two appeared together as a joint front, if you like, on climate change. They made a joint declaration that both countries were equally committed to rolling back carbon emissions, to reining in greenhouse gases, and that they were totally behind COP21. Now, just about every person I interviewed, from the Indians to the Americans to everybody in between at COP21, made a point of recalling that meeting in Beijing and said, basically, that was the crucial breakthrough. That so long as China wasn't totally on board, the Americans weren't going to do anything because, Congress would say, why should we do something? China isn't doing anything. So long as the U.S. wasn't totally on board, China wasn't going to do anything. And Obama a year ago realized this and realized that very early on he would have to present a kind of united attack with China and make sure that there was no gap between them on this issue.
So you mentioned that on the tail of the terrorist attacks in Paris, the COP21 climate summit began with the city on pins and needles and the world leaders all converging for this summit. How did the climate activists and the police action against them influence the summit, if at all, in your opinion?
You know, the protests and the clashes with the police on the street happened one day before the climate conference opened. It happened on a Sunday. The police were very on edge, and actually I was in the middle of that. It was right at the point at which the attacks had been 2 weeks before. The police, the military, I mean, all the security forces were intensely worried about the fact that you had the biggest collection of heads of state in France since the liberation from the Nazis 70 years ago. I mean, the city had never seen anything like this, or not certainly not in a few generations. And so they were clearly nervous. You had a hardcore of activists who were, it seems, determined to kind of do battle with the police. The great majority of activists had a great peaceful protest, and things went off great until a certain small group of people appeared on the street and were intent on being arrested by the police. Now, the police in Paris are very used to this. This is a city that sees hundreds of demonstrations a year, and the police are not tolerant of it. They come out in force. They are dressed in total full riot gear with tear gas, and they don't waste time using it. So you had a battle which lasted a couple of hours, and then it was over. The city was on lockdown the couple of days that the heads of state were here, and it was under very, very tight security for the rest of COP21. And it ended, in fact, on the last day with a protest that the police allowed to go ahead. They made an exception to what is now a state of emergency in this country since the attacks, where no protests are allowed. And they made an exception for the end of COP21, when you had thousands of climate activists around the Arc de Triomphe and the Eiffel Tower protesting what they thought was too weak an agreement.
Thanks for your perspective coming from Paris, roving correspondent Vivian Walt. Vivian, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Vince Guaraldi, Angelique Kijo, Eric Clapton, and Bob Dylan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.